Welcome to the SEI podcast series, a production of Carnegie Mellon University Software Engineering Institute. The SEI is a federally funded research and development center sponsored by the U.S. Department of Defense and operated by Carnegie Mellon University. A copy of today's podcast can be found at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts. My name is Suzanne Miller. I'm a principal researcher here in the Agile and Government team at the SEI, and I'm here to interview Eileen Rubel as a part of our Women in Software and Cybersecurity series. In addition to everything else, Eileen Rubel is actually my boss, so we know each other a little bit more than I might know some of the other people we interview. So I want to welcome you, Eileen, and thank you for doing this interview, because we always learn things about our colleagues when we do stuff like this, so it'll be fun. So let's start. You and I share something. Mm-hmm. We both are what we call military brats. Yes. Both of our fathers were in the Air Force and moved us all around with them, and that creates a childhood that's a little different than what it might be for somebody who grew up in one place. And so let's talk about your childhood and what kinds of things do you think contributed to where you are today and how you look at the world.
So as a military brat, one of the places I lived was West Berlin in the mid-80s. So that was a pretty interesting time to be alive and a pretty interesting place to live.
Yep.
But I went to three second grades and two third grades, and two fifth grades. So my education was a little disjoint. We've talked in the past about how you go to one school and they've already done that. You go to another school and you sort of miss a unit. And that really created some challenges for me as a kid when it came to learning math in particular. You get to one school and they teach things differently and they're at a different place and you sort of miss or speed through some of the mechanics. And not having sort of a steady foundation in math ed, I think clobbered my self-esteem for a while, and I think it hampered how I approached mathematical problem solving.
So, okay, you go from clobbered math self-esteem to working in software at the Software Engineering Institute. What made the difference for you in making that something that it was even possible in your mind?
So there's a couple pieces to this story, but in high school, I was part of the Air Force Junior ROTC program, and because of my involvement in that, I was eligible for, competed for, and won a four-year Type 1 ROTC scholarship, and that meant, at the time, it was 4 years of a full tuition and books and a stipend. And that was great. And they tailor the major fields of study that are available for those scholarship recipients to meet the needs of the Air Force. And so I was looking at a list of things like nursing and meteorology, various kinds of engineering, computer science, and math. And all through high school, I was a gifted student. I was in all the advanced classes. And I always just had this dogged block about how maybe I just wasn't, maybe I wasn't a math person, because I'd look at my friend Charlie and think, wow, it's just come so much easier to him. And here I am just hanging on by my fingernails. And so I had a talk with my high school calculus teacher, Mr. G. And I said, here's the thing. I have this really incredible opportunity, to go to college fully funded in a STEM field. And I just don't know that I can hack the math. And he looked at me and basically said, you get in your own way. You are perfectly capable. You can do the work. You keep up with everybody. You've just convinced yourself that you can't. So stop complaining. Don't talk to me about this again. And I thought, okay, well, the Air Force says I can do it. And Mr. G says I can do it. Maybe I ought to let go of this idea that I'm just not born to be a math person. So I went to Carnegie Mellon. I studied applied math. And then when I got out of school, the Air Force had commissioned a lot of lieutenants that year and was supportive of opportunities to take your commission into the Guard or Reserves, take educational delays. And so I found an Air National Guard unit and went off and looked for a civilian job. And I talked to a little software company that recruited at just a few schools. And they said, we love mathematicians because you can do anything. Sure. And it turns out the software was all about using applying operations research techniques to strategic, tactical, and real-time challenges in moving ground freight and positioning vehicles and drivers. So that's how I wound up in software, sort of this windy, windy kind of path.
Right. So you're typical of what I of people that I talk to, male, female, doesn't matter, mm-hmm. about I got here not by going what would be the expected. I did math math problems in my head, and right. you know, I was in this math competition, that competition.
Right.
I'm the same way. I think a lot of us came at this from places. I know somebody, more than one person, that actually came out of this after having music education mm-hmm. and working in the music field. So the thing that I'm drawn to is that we all have barriers that many times we put on ourselves.
Yes.
How do you get past that today? Because I know for myself, that doesn't stop. Just because you say, get over that, it doesn't
right.
stop. How do you get through that? What kinds of obstacles did you have to overcome along the way? And where did that sort of, how did you build that confidence that you have today?
So, we deal a lot with things like, even unconscious bias in the workplace. It doesn't matter how confident we are sometimes. If someone else's unconscious perception sort of puts us aside.
Right.
One of the things that has really helped me over the years, and looking back now on a 20-year career, you can get a much more objective view of these kinds of things. But one of the things that really helped me along the way is having really strong mentors. And I didn't really appreciate how valuable professional and personal mentors were when I was
right,
younger.
Right.
But sort of the things that you learn from somebody else's experience and from, facing a challenge and thinking about how would somebody I admire and respect approach this problem,
right.
those kinds of things have helped me out a lot. And thinking, trying to sit back and think, well, I'm at the table, so I know I deserve a seat at the table. So I need to take away all those niggling voices that say, are you sure you belong here? Maybe you don't belong here. But really, having those professional relationships where I'm able to bounce ideas off of people and
okay.
sort of watch how others have sort of navigated these paths has really been tremendously helpful.
So that's actually a very actionable thing that others can take away from this mm-hmm. is that if you don't already have them, find those mentors
yes.
that can help you. When we first talked about the idea of mentorship, my initial reaction is, well, gee, I don't really have mentors. But when I thought about it more mm-hmm. deeply, it's like, well, there was this person and that person, and they guided me in these different situations. And that's really, mentors are not always declared, I guess
right.
is the thing I would say. And so I think many of us don't always think about where were our mentoring kinds of episodes. But
right.
is that true for you as well?
Yes, absolutely. Mentoring is kind of, there's behavior and there's relationships. And I'm certain that there are people who would watch this and say, okay, I can see myself in this conversation. But I'm sure that there are people that I view as part of my personal board of advisors who might be surprised to know that I think of them in that way. And sometimes, like you said, sometimes it's something that happens in a defining moment and you
right.
think, I'm going to package that up. And I'm gonna pocket it, and I'm gonna keep that with me, and that's a lesson that's gonna be with me for my career. And sometimes it's really, over the course of a relationship, watching how someone's perspective is applied to
right.
problems and applied to obstacles. So I think it takes a lot of different forms. I've not been as strategic about knowing how important I think this is now. I've not been as strategic about seeking out. Those opportunities to both give and receive
mm-hmm.
as I probably should have been certainly earlier in my career. And I'm trying to be better about that.
Yeah, you've got a few decades ahead of you, so it's not too late. All right, so let's move forward to the present.
Mm-hmm.
You're the lead of the Continuing Lifecycle Solutions Initiative, and we work together in that arena. So that's a very cool, so I know at least one of the really cool things you get to do. You are very active within our academic and SEI communities. You're mm-hmm. the actual reason that this podcast series was started. Tell me a little bit about why did you see a need for a series about women in software and cybersecurity?
So I have spent my whole career, as I know you have, in male-dominated spaces. And we joke, you joke that you can count. You go to a senior-level meeting and you can see the gender representation and diversity.
Sure.
And we all know that representation matters. And we're at sort of an inflection point in the industry. Still something like 14% of engineers are women. Mm-hmm. But the incoming computer science class at Carnegie Mellon this year is either gender balanced or tipped slightly towards women. Women still leave these careers at a rate that's 45 or 50% higher than men. And so we're I feel like we're at a tipping point where we're trying to bring more women into these careers so that we have that diversity of representation. But we're not there yet. We need to make that a trend. And I'm at a point in my life where I have the luxury of looking back a little, and I have two daughters. So all of this sort of combined. Mm-hmm. And so I started thinking, you know, as part of more collaboration in our professional community and across the SEI and working on these podcasts, I've been meeting a lot of really fabulous people both inside and outside the SEI. So this was an opportunity to really explore how women are approaching these careers.
What's the coolest thing you get to do in your current role? Let's motivate some women to sort of stay in software long enough to get to where you're at.
So my favorite thing about what we do is, and we talk a lot about how it's so socio-technical and culturally dependent. It's not just enough to write good software if you don't know why you're writing it, and if everybody who's involved isn't, you know, if everybody's not on the same train. And so, you know, over the course of our work, we put together a great team of personalities, of people who are
we're
curious and hungry and committed and compassionate. And then we built this extensive professional collaborators network where folks cross, you know, from across the industry, Department of Defense, the federal government, whatever, where we get together and talk about the problems and the challenges that we're facing, the ideas that we have, what we see coming down the road. And being able to get insight from so many different people in so many different
settings.
So many different settings, so many different angles on these problems is really enriching. And then when we have our annual Agile Colloquium every year, which is a small group where we roll up our sleeves and really go to town about what's happened in the last year and what were our influences and what changes do we want to see and how can we work together regardless of, are we in the government, are we at a university? I love doing that so much. I absolutely love the opportunity to collaborate with so many people who really view that collaboration as an asset.
That's right. Let's talk a little bit more about the socio-technical aspects of software. So one of the things that we've talked about is we don't need all software engineers to build good software. And so one of the things that I look for are people that have that ability to communicate, the ability to translate. I mean, that an ability to translate between the technical and the business or operations is one of the hardest skills to find and one of the most valuable in building software systems. So what would you say to younger women who are sort of making decisions that go, well, that's not me. I don't do math. I don't write software. How can they be involved in software and cybersecurity? What are the paths that they might want to take that you would recommend?
So there's a joke that I don't even remember where I first saw it. It says, you know, science will teach you how to clone dinosaurs, but the liberal arts will teach you why that might not be the best idea.
Right.
And I've had talks with other women as a part of this series, and I think we've talked about this a lot recently, the idea that technology enables even those liberal arts pursuits, and liberal arts pursuits enable technology. And so the thing isn't to think, well, I need to go, people say I need to go get STEM smart because that's what I'm supposed to do. But really think about, how does what I do have a potential to shape or make demands on technology?
Right.
My teenage daughter is a huge history buff. She's very into public policy and politics. And she worked on her first series of political campaigns this year.
Right.
And so she got really good insight into how do we use technology and how do we use data
sets to
understand things about voters or to manage canvassing or to understand the impacts of policy choices.
Right.
So she's on a path that's completely different from, say, my youngest, who is into genetics and physics and chemistry, and using all sorts of fun little tools to model chemical reactions and everything. But there's this, our liberal arts and our I almost don't like to call them, but our soft skills have to meet our technical skills in order to enrich the world. So
one of my mentors is known for saying the soft stuff is the hard stuff.
Yes.
And it's very true. At least once a week, I'm reminded of that when I'm out working with clients. So I know that you've had, we all have had challenging moments in our careers. Mm-hmm. Is there any one that you would want to share that might be able to help others that are going through kind of the challenging moments in their careers and making decisions? As you said, many women decide to pull out of the tech industry. What's something you would say helped you to get past that?
So I have a classic story along those lines. When I was pregnant with my first daughter, it was 2002, so we're still doing the post 9/11 economy, and I was maybe 6 months pregnant when I was laid off from my job as part of a large layoff at a tech firm, and that's not a fun situation to be in when you're in your 20s. And this is when I really started understanding the value of mentorship and networking. The gentleman who had been my boss at this job moved on to somewhere else and was able to sort of, when another opening appeared there, he was able to sort of see what that job needed that I had. And it wasn't somewhere I would have thought to go looking. And so having somebody who knows you and can say, hey, you might want to look. This is a match. You might want to go look these places. You might want to look at, explore these things that didn't come to you initially. Having that extra perspective was really a game changer for me. I was also fortunate that, here at the SEI, my husband and I were a dual career family, and we had long thought about, sort of strategically stepping in and out so that we're, as a family, strategically focusing on one career at a time. And after a few years at the SEI, I said, okay, I'm going to step back now. I'm going to go stay at home, and I'm going to reevaluate the workforce in a few years. And my managers said, well, you might not know this, but we have a history of people sort of moving in and out, stepping in and out, going various degrees of full-time and part-time. And I was able to turn that situation from a exit of the workforce into a little bit of consulting here and there that ultimately led to viable, engaging part-time technical work in my field. And then when I was ready to come back to work full-time, when we were ready to shift our strategic focus as a family, I had remained integrated into all of these networks and had kept my skills and my interests current in our field. And it was a relatively smooth transition back into the full-time world. And I don't think, I mention that because I think it's unique about the SEI, being that we have the academic heritage at the university. Those opportunities either still don't exist enough. I don't think they exist enough, but I also don't think they're as readily apparent to women to ask for.
Even if they're not visible, they might still be there.
Right.
And I will also say, just on the other side, that's when I met you, was when you were in your part-time stage.
That's right.
And having contact with somebody in a you're not there all the time. Of course, none of us are. We travel too much.
Right.
But having contact with you there when you wanted to come back in, I'm not the only one. There was a whole network of people that you had maintained relationships with.
Yes.
And that's the thing I would say is exiting, it reduces your ability to maintain those relationships, where reducing time is another way that you can maybe keep the relationship so you can come back in when you're ready to do more. So that's another takeaway.
Yeah, managing those relationships through career changes or, changes in the season you're in life is so important.
Right. I agree with that. I want to know something. I want to know something I don't know about you that doesn't relate to work, because we are not just workers. We are people. And so tell me something interesting about what you do outside of work. Okay, it can be something I already know, but they're not going to know.
Okay, so I'll tell you something interesting about me that's really unusual, and then I'll tell you something that lots of people don't know about me but is less unusual. One of my wedding photos appears on a greeting card in Poland.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Okay.
The photographer who shot our wedding provided all the negatives to us but retained copyright for publication, and one of the photos was published in a photography series, and we have a copy of the book, But we also discovered that it was on a lovey-dovey greeting card in Poland for a few years.
Cool. So there you go.
So that was fun. And then another thing about me, I'm an avid runner. So when my husband and I vacation, often there's a marathon attached to it. And then, you know, we can sort of say, well, but look, we're doing hard work. Mm. So we love to travel anyway, but I love to run. I've done a handful of marathons and a pile of half marathons, and that really helps me get my headspace
right
cleared out on a regular basis.
And we've talked about the fact that that's when you're in these very intense kinds of career fields, mm-hmm. whatever it is, whether it's running, I go do weird camping every year. You know, other people go to the, you know, coast of Maine and sort of disconnect. You've got to have some way of balancing mm-hmm. that intensity
yes.
with sort of your letting your brain rest a little bit, or at least have something else taking
right.
over your brain for a while. And endorphins when you're running is
yes.
a choice that a lot of people may not think of, but is one that I know has worked for you, because
yes.
if you don't run for too long,
yes.
You know, you're not as happy.
I am not as happy.
And we don't want that. We don't want that. Advice that you would give to people that are thinking about a tech career and a software and a cybersecurity career that, you know, may not be sort of what you would call the typical advice that you'll hear from everybody else. What would you add to that list of things that people hear?
Be constantly curious. It can be easy to get good at something and stay good at that one thing and watch the world pass you by, right? So constantly staying curious, I think helps people stay, you know, more fully engaged,
sure.
But it also ensures that you're going to have lots of long-term options. And you're gonna be fun to work with because you always wanna learn new things and you're always bringing
right.
new things to the table. And my other thing is, I can't stress enough the importance of actively seeking out mentors. And those don't have to be people that are going to spend a ton of time with you, but really looking around your professional settings, volunteer work that you do, and seeing who has lessons that you think you really want to hang on to that you can build long-term
right.
relationships with. Those two things really matter.
Okay. So one of the challenges in our industry is mm-hmm. staying current. You're talking about being curious.
Yes.
And so how do you decide where to put that curiosity, where to put your focus when you're trying to keep up with everything that's going on in our world?
Filter, filter, filter. it is hard. There's this influx of information, right? This deluge. Things are always happening,
yep.
and you can't keep up with all of it. You can't pay attention to everything. And I sort of had to let that go a long time ago.
And not all of it is worth paying attention to.
That's true.
That's one of the things that's, I think,
right.
really hard about this is it's as valuable to know what to let go of and not mm-hmm. finish even sometimes as it is to find the good stuff.
Right, to keep the signal-to-noise ratio
exactly.
really, really high. This is a space, again, where I look to my colleagues and I look to the people that I look up to, and I think about what are they reading, what are they bringing to the table. And so there's things I pay attention to on a regular basis. You know, Jez Humble's Twitter feed, I read Jennifer Palka's blog. LinkedIn is really useful for this because
mm-hmm.
I can see not only what people are reading, what they're commenting on, but a lot of our collaborators and friends are also publishing in various
right.
ways
right.
their experiences. And seeing, you know, being able to pull things out of experience reports that go with, you know, trends in industry and everything else, being able to sort of assemble those things into a meaningful space in my head is useful. But I really rely on my network of colleagues and mentors as sort of a filtering function. And then if you walk into my office and said, I read this book and I think you really need to read it because it's going to change your perspective on what we're doing
right,
with X,
right.
I'm going to prioritize that and put it up at the top of my stack.
Oh.
Likewise, right? If I need to know, hey, I want to get smart about this, or I read about this problem over here, I can ask the people that are in my network, what's the thing I should read on that? I kind of know who to go to ask those questions.
Right.
And then you sort of don't have to filter through as much of the chaff to get at the really good stuff.
You know, something else that I do that I is kind of weird, I realized, is when I go into somebody's office, I look at their bookshelf.
Yes.
And I look at what are the books
mm-hmm.
on their bookshelf that I haven't read that might be useful And I can ask them about it. It's, mm-hmm. And you know, most of the time they have read it, and they can either tell me, oh, it's trash or not. Yeah. But, you know, there's some things that are actually much more physical, like,
right.
than what I have in my Kindle reading list, you know, mm-hmm. Per se. So, yeah, I struggle with that, too. And the filtering, I think we all do the same right. thing. If somebody I know and respect says this is something important, then I'm more likely to go ahead and make the time to read that than if it's just something random that comes across in the recommended reading. You know,
right.
because you read X, you might like Y. You know, that's something for people to pay attention to.
And we did, you know, last year at our Agile Colloquium, we did a round table yeah. where we said, what's on your bookshelf now?
Yep.
What are you reading
yep.
now? And so we were able to have conversations with folks as we're putting up our stickies about
yep.
what we're reading. So that was a lot of fun. But I also try to reach out when I'm asking people to come speak at events or come to a meeting where they're, you know, something where they're keynoting or they're a featured speaker or someone people will be curious about. I always ask them if they can be prepared to say, you know, what am I reading right now?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
what two things would you recommend that people read? And that's just a useful way to keep building that mental list.
And of course, in today's world, read is not just with your eyes, right?
We right.
also, you've been working on me to get more into the podcast world.
Yep.
I know, I film them, but do I listen to them? Not so much. But that is another vehicle that we have for a lot of the technical content out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed at how much content
yes.
is there either through YouTube, you know, videos or just through audio podcasts. So,
and if you're going to be commuting, podcasts are a really good way to
yeah.
get smart
yeah.
while you're a captive audience.
Yeah, I know. So you say. I'll get there. All right. I do want to thank you for joining us today.
Yeah,
I always learn new things when I talk to you. And so I'm very, very grateful that you started this series and very happy that we got a chance to talk together like this. So for our viewers, this podcast is available in many places now, and you can find it on Stitcher, SoundCloud, iHeartRadio. If you can't find it there, then it's always going to be at sei.cmu.edu/podcast. In addition, if you have any questions for us, please don't hesitate to email us at info@sei.cmu.edu. Thank you very much for viewing.